Thank you for listening to this teaching from Forerunner Fellowship. For more teachings or to subscribe to our podcast, as well as information about our congregation, visit our website at forerunnerfellowship.org.
All right, so David's Tabernacle. This is where I want to go for session two. So a brief review. Last time, this is a month ago, we talked about was like the New Covenant or the New Testament priesthood. Honestly, I think Brad's message the following week was like, man, that really summed up, I think, excellently. You know, I kind of felt the same way. Sophia, after hearing Brad's message, I was like, gosh, I'm so thankful for Brad Stoop. But the main thing that I was coming to when I was looking over it is that, man, the royal priesthood and the new covenant really does come down to just, you know, we pray together, we provide together, we proclaim together, we pursue together. It was really this, like, it was almost this brand new family that was going to go after God and embrace God all together, and they were going to build this thing. But then there's this real interesting thing that happens in Acts 15. It's where they find out Gentiles are coming into the kingdom. And they say, what do we do about this? And everybody's, you know, suggesting this or that. And James says, hey, remember what it says in Amos 9? It says, after this, I'll return and I'll rebuild the tabernacle of David. So that's that 24/7 prayer and worship, which has fallen down. I'll rebuild its ruins and I'll set it up so the rest of mankind may seek the Lord, even all the Gentiles who are called by my name. So James is saying that this is the evidence that God is beginning to fulfill Amos 9. The fact that Gentiles, their hearts are getting touched with the message of God, and that they're like, oh my gosh, I want to run after God too. I want to be a part of this promise. And there's actually a way for me to now through Jesus Christ, that I have access to it. I don't have to just be born a Jew. I don't have to just be born in Israel. I don't have to just join and be a part of a nation. I can actually stay whatever whatever, you know, ethnicity I am, and I can have parts. So James is pointing out, he's saying, hey, this was bound to happen because Amos 9 still has to be fulfilled. Like, the only way you're going to have Gentiles building David's tabernacle is you had to have Gentiles getting brought into the covenant somehow. So James is like, oh, I guess this is how it's going to start to happen, is we'll have to evangelize to Gentiles. So, David's tabernacle, what is it? So I think we're just going to start with kind of the story leading up to it, all right? Because you can look at David's life, and it is fantastic. You can pull so many leadership lessons. You can pull, you know, lessons for what should you do as a young man, what should you do as a leader, what should you do as an old man, what should you do as a leader over a movement. There's so many different lessons you can pull from David's life. He's wonderful. But if all that you really knew about David's life was just the David and Goliath story, and then that he became king, but you don't really know anything else except for, like, man, David, you know, stomped some Philistines. You know, because I remember growing up in the church, and I knew David, but I had no idea that David had a tabernacle. Nobody ever talked about it. I knew the David and Goliath story. I knew David loved to stomp Philistines. I knew he was good at it. I knew that was kind of it. I knew that he maybe wrote some of the Psalms, but there wasn't really any connection to, like, how did this guy who is so good at fighting this one group of people and everybody else, how did he write all these songs too? I'm like, dude, this guy is so metal. Never really made the connection. So, 2 Samuel. So David, at this point, he's become king over all Israel. If you haven't ever just read the story, it is a fantastic read. I want to encourage you, if you've never just read the story of, like, how it happens, of Saul's downfall, then David's rise, and then how it kind of comes to be where David becomes king. It's just, it's a fascinating just story to get your mind around. So David becomes king. Now it's when the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel. The Philistines went up to search for David. So this is David. He was king over just Judah, but it got consolidated. They ended up crushing this rebellion. I think it was maybe Ishbosheth. I don't know. They're hard names. And so Israel goes ahead and anoints David as king over the whole thing. He consolidates basically all the tribes. Philistines hear about it, and they go up to fight David. So they go up to fight David, and David defeats them, and they brought basically like all their gods and all their images and all their things up there with them. The Philistines, they still have the ark at this point. They still had the ark because I think this was back with Eli. Israel was fighting. They were in rebellion. They thought they could just take the ark out to a battle, and that it would, even though they were living in compromise, that God would just honor it and then help them win the battle. They get defeated, and the Philistines take the ark. So the ark has been with the Philistines. So David, and I think this is actually where David and his men, I think this is where they get it back, is that the Philistines, they bring like all their gods out of their temple to the battle, and then they have a fight, and then David beats them so bad that they leave all their images, they leave all their things there. And so the Israelites take them, because... So David gets the ark, 1 Chronicles 13. So David, he sees they won the battle. It's also 2 Samuel 6. So David, he consulted with the captains of thousands and hundreds and with every leader, and he said, hey, let's bring the ark of our God back to us, for we've not inquired of it since the days of Saul. He's saying like, hey, let's like take the ark and let's like set it back up again. You know, it's been like a few decades that this thing has been missing. This is a really big deal. So David, everybody is like, yeah, this can work. David, let's do it. You know, we've got the ark. Let's do it. So, man, 1 Chronicles 13. This is the rockiest start in the history of the prayer movement. I guarantee you there has never been a house of prayer that started this bad. As David's tabernacle. All right, so I'm going to read it. 1 Chronicles 13, it's 7 through 12. So they carried the Ark of God on a brand new cart, and David and all of Israel, they played music. This is starting out really good, okay? They've got the whole nation. And they're before God, they're with all of their might. There was singing, they have harps, they have stringed instruments. Everybody is engaged. And they are like, this really looks like revival is happening in the nation. Everybody is going for it. And then they come to Chidon's threshing floor, and Uzzah puts out his hand to hold the ark because the oxen tripped. Oh, and then the anger of the Lord was aroused. And then he struck him, and then Uzzah died. And then David gets angry, and then David gets afraid, and he's like, I quit. Never has a house of prayer started so bad. Or, like you could even say, never has a house of prayer had so much promise and help on the front end and still started so badly. Like, someone actually died in the prayer meeting on the first day of the prayer meeting. And the person died because the one they were ministering to got mad at him. As someone who has been in, you know, the rock piling prayer meetings, I just really appreciated this because I was like, you know, I even tried to reflect on this passage and just to think of like, what are some thoughts? You know, I was like, there's a lot here. You know, if you just kind of read it and you haven't done the house of prayer, you will pass over this and it won't really catch you. But if you've done it for any length of time and you've kind of felt the pressure and the trouble and all of the different promises, if I just had this or if I just had this, then it'd be, it's like you, this, I hope that this helps you. So number one, money, celebrity, and lots of talented people do not build the house of prayer. If you think that's what's holding back the prayer room, or if you think that's what's holding back your small house of prayer, wherever it is, you're wrong, and that's an accusation. Because David had lots of money, lots of talented people, lots of energy, lots of celebrity, And his prayer meeting, someone died in it the first day. Okay? So that's not the reason that, it's not the way that you build the house of prayer. Number two, the house of prayer has always been hard. It has never not been challenging. So if there's this, well, I don't want to do it. It's just hard. It's just too hard. That's how it's always been. It has never not been challenging. And it will always stay challenging. Number three, people have always gotten hurt. That's an accusation I've heard. It's like, man, the house of prayer just hurts people. It chews them up and spits them out and just leaves them burn out and their heart's offended. It's like, sorry, that's been happening since the get-go. It's not the house of prayer's fault, though. It's the person's fault. Number four, the house of prayer defeats everyone. It does. It's like a furnace. You get in there. I mean, right here, this is a lot different. This wasn't the decades long of sitting in the meetings furnace, but it really is. It defeats you. You get there, you're with the music, and all of your weaknesses just start coming to the surface as you have 2 hours that you're trying to process and you're trying to like engage with the Lord, and then you come face to face with your bored heart and you're like, what do I do? Because you were so excited that it wasn't like that and that actually wasn't how your heart was. You were so excited because you knew that you really loved God and you really loved the Bible because you sang songs loud and you raised your hands and you danced and you had zeal, and then you come face to face with your brokenness and you're like, oh, gosh, this is hard. It defeats everyone. Number five, everyone has had second thoughts. Even David, the guy who started it. David has second thoughts. He's afraid of God, and he's like, how can I bring the ark of God? Like, how do I even do this? I want to do this. It's in my heart to do this, but I don't know how to do it. And he basically quits for like 3 months. He doesn't know what to do. He's like, I don't know. I don't know what to do. Even David quit the house of prayer for like 3 months. He didn't stay there. He's trying to figure out how to do it. But that's like, I was kind of blown away. I was like, wow, David, even David quit. So Obed-Edom's house. So they decide that they're going to take the ark, because at this point, imagine like a whole procession, like, you know, a parade, like the New York City parade, you know, the New Year's parade, just tens of thousands of people, and they're parading the ark, and then the guy at the very front of the parade dies because God strikes him. The parade is over. They set the ark there. And everybody's like, what do we do? What do we do? They just set it. I just feel like everybody just kind of run. I bet some people run away. Some people probably scream. Like, it is absolute pandemonium. This is chaos. So the chaos dies down, and they decide, well, what are we going to do? So Obed-Edom, he's like, I'll take it to my house. Obed-Edom was a priest. He was, I think he was a worship leader. I know he's a gatekeeper when actually the ministry actually starts. So Obed-Edom's like, hey, you know, my house is just past the wheat field. We can take it over there. And they're like, okay, good, we'll do that. So the ark remained, 1 Chronicles 13, verse 14, says it remained with the family of Obed-Edom in his house 3 months. And the Lord blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that he had. I'm going to read this second one. Now it was told King David, saying, the Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the ark of God. This is like kind of shocking. Think about anything that in 3 months' time, you can see a blessing in every single area of your life, that it's noticeable. It's so noticeable that all of your neighbors and all of the people around you and everybody who has grown up with you and done life with you sees there is something different about Obed-Edom. He has got something on his life right now. What is going on? and they start talking. They keep talking. They talk so much, they go, David, you remember the ark? You were trying to bring it up? Dude, Obed-Edom, every single area of his life has been touched because of it. David's like, what do you mean? He's like, every area, like the neighbor's wheat is here, his wheat is here, all of his sheep are like 20 pounds fatter than the others. He's got like a huge, you know, harvest of such and such. He bought this other thing, he got it for a good deal. Like, it's every single area of his life has been touched in such a dramatic way. In only 3 months, it's become the talk of the nation. Think about that. That is not just minor blessing. That is significant. That is crazy. So David gets encouraged. David's like, whoa, we need to do something about this. So David, he decides he's going to try it again. So 1 Chronicles 15, verse 11 through 13. So David gets a tough start. But he sees there's a solution. So David calls for Zadok and Abiathar the priest, and he says, hey, sanctify yourselves, you and your brethren, that you may bring up the ark of the Lord. Because we didn't do it the first time. The Lord our God broke out against us because we didn't consult him about the proper order. So David learns this really important lesson about the house of prayer, that you do not build the house of prayer because you think you want to build the house of prayer. You do not build the house of prayer because you have the people to build the house of prayer. You do not build it because you have finances, you have whatever. You consult the Lord and you ask him, Lord, is it time? What should we do? Is it time to add another set? Is it time to do this? Is it time? And you ask the Lord and you get led by the Lord. And so David learns this lesson. He's like, man, it's not by might, not by power, but it's by my spirit, says the Lord. David learns the by my spirit, says the Lord, before it even like comes out. But that's really that whole that whole promise of not by might, not by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord. It's like, it's really embodying David's realization of like, man, I cannot do this with all of my strength, with all of my armies, with all of my captains of all my armies and all my money. I've got to do this a different way. So what do? They get the priests in place. They get all Israel assembled again. They get the sacrifices set up. And they go and it's not just an event, but it becomes something that gets established. So, you know, the next one in verse 16. David, he speaks to the leaders of the Levites to appoint their brethren to be singers accompanied by instruments of music, stringed instruments, harps, and cymbals, raising the voice with a sounding joy. It's the same thing, but it's a different group of people. He says, I'm not just finding talented people. I'm not just finding anybody. I'm putting specific people in the place. I'm putting the ones who are called, they're called to be singers. They're called to be musicians. I'm putting them in their place and I'm saying, hey, you guys do it. Y'all are going to do it. The reason the Lord broke out is because we didn't do it this way. So we're going to do it the right way. And then in verse 28, so all Israel brings the ark of the Lord with shouting, with the sound of the horn, with trumpets, with cymbals, making music, with string instruments and harps. So they actually complete it. They bring it up into the city. And this is where revival breaks out. So I want to bring everyone's attention to, remember Asbury. Asbury just happened. You were living under a rock if you didn't know that Asbury just happened or what it is. But Asbury, it's this little college. And like a move of the Spirit and awakening started happening. And they were calling it revival, but whenever you go and if, you know, you went to it, everyone's like, this feels just like a prayer meeting, because the revival basically turned into just a 24/7 worship and prayer gathering of gazing upon the beauty of Jesus, and that we're calling that revival. It's like, but wait, I thought that that was what the 24/7 prayer and worship gathering, gazing at the beauty of Jesus was for, that we would ask for that. Lord, you did the thing backwards. You brought the revival and then we started the meeting. That's exactly what happens in Israel. Like after they get it set up, 1 Chronicles 16 So this is, they've gotten it set up. They've just had this day of celebrating. David passes out bread and like cakes and gifts to everyone in the entire nation. And he dismisses them to like get back to, you know, doing life together. But he says, hey, hold on a second. Asaph, you and your brothers, you are to minister there before the ark of the Lord, to minister before the ark regularly as every day's work required. He says, Asaph, you and your brothers, you stay here. You're like, well, what about our food? Don't you worry about that. I'll get that sorted out. He says, but you guys stay here. This is going to be your new job. David decides there's no reason that this has to stop. We're going to keep doing this. So then how do we know that this is revival? Verse 39 and 40. It's not just Asaph, but it's Zadok and the priest and his brethren the priest. They're offering burnt offerings to the Lord on the altar regularly, morning and evening, with a commitment to do according to all that is written in the law of the Lord, which he commanded Israel. They're basically, the entire nation has decided, we're going to do this prayer and worship thing, we're going to sing songs to God, we're going to do the law like he said, and then we're going to try to do every single thing that the law tells us and how to live and how to operate our lives. This is a radical commitment to holiness, and it's touched everyone in the nation. Even though it doesn't use the words revival, that is what revival is. It's when everybody comes and decides we are going to do things God's way. We're going to give our lives to God and be holding God. So God establishes a revival. He even makes this covenant with David. It's over the establishment of the house of prayer. It's in 1 Chronicles 17. So this is where David decides, it's a little bit longer. They've been doing the meetings in the tent, and David's like, man, I'm actually going to build him a temple. He's got it in his heart. He wants to build him a temple. So then he asks, I think it's Nathan the prophet. He says, Nathan, I want to build God a temple. Nathan's like, sure, do everything that's in your heart, bro. You know, you love God. Go for it. Nathan has a dream that night where the Lord comes to him and basically like speaks to him and gives him a message that he's supposed to go give to David. So this is just part of the message he's telling him. He says, hey, he shall build me a house, and I'm going to establish his throne forever. I'll be his father. He shall be my son. And I'm going to establish him in my house and in my kingdom forever. And his throne shall be established forever. Nathan gives David the beginning of the Psalm 110 psalm. This is Psalm 110 language. Even though he's talking about Solomon, Solomon doesn't have an everlasting throne or a kingdom forever or is established in his house forever. This is the promises about Jesus that we looked at last time in Psalm 110. He says, hey, you know, like sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. You're a high priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek, Psalm 110. Nathan's giving him the foundation of Psalm 110. Right here, when he's saying, hey, because it was in your heart to do this, not only am I going to do this, but it's actually going to be through this desire that's in your heart that I'm going to set up my eternal kingdom. It's through this that I'm going to make it someone who is your son who will also build a house forever. I was just blown away. I was like, oh my gosh. Isaiah 55, it's not just there. It says, incline your ear, come to me. Hear and your soul shall live, and I'll make an everlasting covenant with you. What's the covenant? The sure mercies of David. I've given him as a witness to the people. When God says, I've given this guy as a witness to the people, we could say, this guy's life is a model. You should model your life after this guy. So it's the source of future breakthrough. Solomon finishes the temple. God appears to him. It's not just that the revival was in David's era. It's not just that, you know, revelation starts breaking out because they're singing before the Lord regularly. It's that God even says, hey, I'm going to actually establish this is the way future breakthrough is going to come. It's going to be through this. Second Chronicles 7, he says, then the Lord appears to Solomon. He says, hey, I've heard your prayer, and I've chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. And if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I'll hear from heaven and I'll forgive their sin and heal their land. God gives the promise of the future breakthrough and the future healing of the nation. It was about coming back and doing David's tabernacle and doing the David's tabernacle thing, which isn't just doing prayer and worship 24 hours a day. It's doing prayer and worship 24 hours a day with a real spirit of sincere love that was a holy, is an obedience-based love. It's like, I'm going to fully obey you while I fully behold you. So David, golly, I don't know if there is ever a mention before this of where someone is touching intimacy-based obedience. So when God gives the law, like to Israel, it was kind of like blessings and curses. We have that, I think it's Deuteronomy 28, where he says, hey, you got to do this and I'll bless you, and if you don't do this, I'm going to hurt you. And that was like the promise that God sets before the nation. David understands the promise, but there's something else that's going on. He says here in the 2 Chronicles 7, he's talking to Solomon, so he says, hey, as for you, if you'll walk before me as your father David walked and do according to all that I've commanded you and you keep my statutes and my judgments, then I'll establish the throne of your kingdom as I covenanted with David your father. But like, David was touching, like, we know in the new covenant that it's the same laws, it's the same process, the holiness, but we have the Holy Spirit by how we can like actually do it. I obey God not just because I want to follow the rules, but because I really love God. It's love-based obedience. David's touching love-based obedience before love-based obedience is even given as a gift to the people. This is incredible. I've got to give my plug for evangelism. 1 Chronicles 16, 23 and 24. This is on the day that they start. The day that the ark gets here, it says, "This on this day, David handed this psalm to Asaph." And in that psalm, it says, "Sing to the Lord, all the earth. Proclaim the good news of his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the nations and his wonders among all the peoples." You see, prayer and evangelism, it was there at the very beginning. It was never two different movements. It was always the same movement. It was that the people who are beholding God, you behold God, and then you go out and you tell everybody how beautiful he is. And that, hey, come with me. Come behold God with me. That was the whole, like, the foundation of it. So it's the promise of fascination. I got to skip forward just a little bit. All right, so the house of prayer continues. So God, he reaffirms his commitment with the house of prayer. It's a corporate expression of national worship. And so he says in, 2 Chronicles 7, verse 15 and 16, he says, hey, now my eyes are going to be open and my ears are going to be attentive to prayer made in this place. For I've chosen and I've sanctified this house that my name may be there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. So God keeps, he reaffirms his commitment to this. It wasn't just the dream of one man, David. God said, I really like it, and I want it to be this way forever. I really want you guys to do this. We'll look at it next month in that last session. I'll see if we can't get all the different times where the nation went astray, and every single time that they came back to the Lord, coming back to the Lord meant picking back up David's tabernacle and doing night and day worship with the Spirit of holiness. So what was David's tabernacle? There are musicians there. You see it, 1 Chronicles 25. It says, David and the captains of the army, they separated for service. Some of the sons of Asaph and Heman, the masters of the universe, and Jeduthun, who should prophesy with harps, stringed instruments, and cymbals. And it's see it again, like all these were under the direction of their father for the music and the house of the Lord. So there's musicians. There's an actual like musician protocol, like, hey, you, like, what's your job? My job is I'm a musician. That's what you do for the nation? Yep, that's what I do. I'm a musician. That's my job. Me and my brothers, our job is to play our instrument and to practice our instruments and to learn more about instruments and to learn all the psalms and to learn the keys and to learn all the chords and to learn the notes and to learn what a flatted fifth is. And that's what our job is to do. There's a training school. I didn't see this until I was looking at it. 1 Chronicles 25, verse 8. There's a training school. They cast lots for their duty, the small as well as the great. The teacher with the student. This is talking about the musicians. And as they're casting lots for, like, what set are they going to take? Like, hey, I took the 20th lot, so it means, you know, I'm going to be on the night watch. It's like they cast the lots, and you have a teacher with the student. You have the small as well as the great. They're talking about, like skill and, like, how good you are at your musical instrument. So there was a in-process training. That means there was actually musicians in David's tabernacle who weren't good at being musicians. I'm just saying. It's been like this since the beginning. It's been like this since the beginning. So if you go to the prayer room and you're like, man, you know, some of the musicians, some of them are like are great, some of them are small, some of them are in between, some are whatever. It's always been that way. Nothing's new under the sun. It was there in David's day. That's why they have a music school. There's singers. Verse 7. So the number of them with their brethren who were instructed in the songs of the Lord, all who were skillful was 288. So all who were skillful was 288. But we know that there was teachers and students. So I'm thinking there was more than 288. When you look at the size of David's army, like when he does the census, you see that there's like a million or something people in the nation. I think that there's more than just 300, you know, musicians and like 5,000 people. I think that's how many you have that are actual like singers and actually like talented people, but you still had the up-and-comers. There's ushers, there's service roles, 1 Chronicles 23, 32, that they should attend to the needs of the tabernacle, the needs of the holy place, and the needs of the sons of Aaron, their brethren, and the work of the house of the Lord. They did it day and night as a continual thing. They stand every morning, 1 Chronicles 23, verse 30, they stand every morning to thank and to praise the Lord, and likewise at evening, they stand there. Guys, the house of prayer isn't something that's new, okay? This isn't something that was just thought of, you know, in Kansas City. This wasn't Mike Bickle's dream. If you listen to the Kansas City history, the prophetic history, you'll see that, if anything, Mike Bickle kind of was very resistant to it. He's very transparent about how not on board necessarily he was all the way through, and how the Lord really like confirmed it to him continuously. Like I knew Brad actually pre-prayer room. I knew Brad when Brad was about saved year and a half, and he never talked about the prayer room or end times. Brad was just in love with Jesus. I knew about, I was a youth, I think I was in seventh grade when I met Brad, so saved about a year and a half, and I remember just kind of being struck because Brad was like, maybe like the first Christian that we were like, man, this guy really does really love God. There's something, he's really taking the Bible seriously. And we were in the youth group, and none of us were really actually taking the Bible seriously. You know, we didn't really even read it. I remember he did a challenge that said, hey, if you will just read the Bible through in 3 months, I'll give you $100. Brad didn't have $100 to give. That was like his whole paycheck. If y'all heard his stories about how broke Brad was and how he was giving away like 30% of his income when he had a $100 salary and he's left with like $71 or something like that. This was when Brad was making the challenge. And none of us did it because none of us cared. But Brad still kept building it. He kept building it. He kept building it. He lived with my family for the 3 months before he went to Africa and the 3 months after he got back from Africa. My brother had gone off to college. I still didn't ever hear him mention the house of prayer or end times. But I remember when Brad started a Bible study after he had a house. And we've been doing a Bible study for like 7 or 8 months, and we were just hungry to know God. We wanted to love God. We just wanted to find out what the Bible said, that it was real. And then the Lord encountered that man and said, start a daily prayer meeting tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. and don't stop until I return. And everything changed. And so I remember he told us, we're like, I don't even know what that is. It's the first time I ever heard what a prayer meeting was. We went the next day. It didn't make sense for years. But it was incredible because it was going on for years and it never missed. It never missed ever. And now it's like 17-something years later and there's still not ever been a day that's been missed, a meeting that's been missed, a thing that's been missed. I'm just telling you, like, whatever the argument is that's keeping you from joining a prayer meeting somewhere, I'm not even saying you have to do it at the prayer room. I'm saying if you come to church here and the only three things we do as a congregation is both attend this meeting, join a small group, and we ask you to join a sacred trust, I would say join the sacred trust of the place that's here. Like, it's not just that you need God to give you a dream that tells you you need to be a part. It's that there's so much evidence that this is the Bible. The guy that God says, this is the witness I'm giving you. This was his dying request. 1 Chronicles 23:27 through 28. By the last words of David, the Levites were numbered from 24 years old and above because their duty was to help the sons of Aaron build the house of prayer. To his dying day, David's like, wait. We can bring the age limit from 30 down to 24 and we can get more people in there. Write it down. Till the very end of his life, this is what he wants to do. And it just moved the heart of God. You see, God referenced this over and over and over again. He even brings it up in the New Testament. He says, hey, that thing that fell down, I liked it. I'm going to rebuild it. And I'm going to bring more people in. I'm going to bring more people in. That psalm that David delivered on the first day where there was going to be singing all over the world, that there was going to be people singing and praising his name, declaring the wonder of God. He's like touching Isaiah 43 before Isaiah 43 ever even happens. Like, there's so much of the promises of the what people were saying that all they're doing is just repeating what David already did. Most of the rest of the Old Testament after David's life is not new. It's still just talking about what David was doing just in different ways and saying, hey, it's going to get back to what David was doing. Y'all just wait and see. God's going to do it. He's going to heal this nation and you're going to start doing what David was doing. And the Lord even says it. Worship team, if you want to come up. He says it, Isaiah 66. The very end of Isaiah's his book, thus says the Lord. He says, heaven is my throne, and earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you will build me? And where is the place of my rest? God is still asking the question. He says, where? It's not if. It's really a question of like where and who. God's going to build a house of prayer. He's going to establish it all over the earth. He's going to give it strength. He's going to make it glorious. He's going to shake everything that can be shaken. And he's going to bring the silver and the gold and make the latter temple more glorious than the former temple. He's going to perform his word. The question is, who's he going to do it with? I just want to encourage you. That's the response time. It's not even, I want the Lord to touch you. I do. I want God to touch you. But really the response time is, if this is like, if you feel like this is true, what I'm saying, that I haven't lied to you, I just want to encourage you. Sign up for a prayer meeting. Like, the response isn't that we just wait and we ask God to, like, touch our heart with some fire, or we, like, feel His presence, or we feel something cool. I love feeling something cool. I love feeling God. I love it when He touches my heart and I cry and I feel tender. But it's not always about Him touching my heart. It's about me touching His. And He says, this is how you can do it. Sign up. Come sit before me. Come build me a resting place, both here that other people can attend, and build me a resting place inside of you. This is how you build a resting place. You sit before Him. You listen to Him. It's okay if it's boring at first. It won't always stay boring. It's okay if the Bible doesn't make sense at first. Keep reading it. It will make sense. It's okay if you don't know the words to the Psalms. You'll learn them. I'm just saying, that's the response. I just want to, if you're not a part of a prayer meeting, I just want to encourage you, respond, commit. I'm not going to go another week. I'm going to sign up.
This concludes this teaching from Forerunner Fellowship. For more information about our congregation, visit forerunnerfellowship.org. Thank you.